Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, the Pope and the People. We have a report on Pope Francis's Wednesday General Audience, where he spoke about the sacrament of baptism in his continuing reflections on Christian hope. From Jewish philosopher to Catholic saint and martyr, we explore the life and personality of St. Theresia Benedicta of the Cross, born as Edith Stein, who was killed by the Nazis at Auschwitz, and treasures of the Basilica of St. Mary Major. With August the 5th marking the consecration of Rome's Basilica of St. Mary Major, join us on a tour of this church that contains some of the world's finest artwork. We begin our broadcast with a report on Pope Francis's Wednesday General Audience, his first since his summer break over the month of July. During his catechesis, the Pope resumed his reflections on the subject of Christian hope, focusing on the sacrament of baptism, describing it as the day we were marked by the light of Christ. Christopher Wells reports.
Cari fratelli e sorelle, buongiorno.
In his catechesis, Pope Francis spoke about several aspects of the baptismal liturgy. To be a Christian means to look to the light, to continue to make the profession of faith in the light, even when the world is wrapped up in the night and in darkness.
I cristiani non sono esenti dalle tenebre esterne anche.
Christians, he said, are not exempt from darkness. They do not live outside the world, but through the grace of Christ received in baptism, they are men and women who are oriented. They do not believe in darkness, but in the brightness of the day. They do not succumb to the night, but hope in the dawn. They are not defeated by death, but are yearning to rise again. They are not bent down by evil, because they trust always in the infinite possibilities of goodness. And this, he said, is our Christian hope. The Pope also looked at the symbolism of the gift of a candle during the baptism ceremony. The candle is lit from the Paschal candle and recalls the Easter Vigil liturgy when the light goes out from the Paschal candle to all the individual candles and the whole church is illuminated.
La vita della Chiesa è contaminazione di luce.
The life of the church, the Pope said, using a strong expression, is a kind of contamination by the light of Christ, which is spread from one to another. The more the light of Christ that we have as Christians, he said, the more of the light of Jesus there is in the life of the church, and the more the church lives. Finally, Pope Francis gave the faithful a kind of homework assignment. He asked those present to remember the day of their baptism, which, he said, is the date of your rebirth. It's the date of the light. It's the date in which we were contaminated by the light of Christ.
Che grazia quando un cristiano diventa veramente Cristoforo.
What a grace it is, the Holy Father said in conclusion, when a Christian truly becomes a Christopher, a bearer of Christ in the world. If we would be faithful to our baptism, the Pope said, we would spread the light of hope. Baptism is the beginning of hope, the hope of God, and we would pass on to future generations reasons for life. I'm Christopher Wells.
We turn now to the figure of St. Theresia Benedicta of the Cross, whose feast day is marked this week. Born Edith Stein in 1891, she was a German Jew who became a philosopher, but then converted to Catholicism after reading the works of St. Teresa of Avila. She later became a discalced Carmelite sister. But along with other Jewish converts, she was arrested by the Nazis on August the 2nd, 1942. Just days later, Theresia was deported to the Auschwitz concentration camp, where she was killed in the gas chambers on August the 9th. Veronica Scarsbrick spoke to discalced Carmelite father Ulrich Dobham to find out more about this remarkable woman.
So Father Ulrich, who was the Carmelite Saint Teresa Benedicta of the Cross?
Mm-hmm.
What makes her so relevant to us in today's society?
Her personal history, her life, her personality.
What's so special about her personality?
Her personality is a very intelligent woman coming from a Jewish family, outstanding philosopher in Germany. She was an assistant of Edmund Husserl in these times, maybe he was the most famous philosopher in Germany. She got the doctorate with him, summa cum laude. And her conversion to Catholicism was not so normal, because in this time many Jewish converted to Christianism, but to the Protestant confession. And she, led or convinced by Teresa of Avila,
who lived
in the 16th century in Spain, convinced by her, finally she decided to become a Catholic Christian in the Catholic Church.
The sequence of her conversion was strange. Jewish born, then she was atheist at one point.
She never uses the word atheist. She used the word unbeliever. And in the age of 14, it was in Hamburg, when she was in the house of her sister, she decided to give up all the prayers. It doesn't mean that she became an atheist, especially her niece living in California, the daughter of her youngest sister. She always insists, saying it is not a real atheism when a girl with 15 or 14 years old decides to give up the prayers. Another question is, in what an extent she had known the real Jewish religion? Because after, when she was a Catholic, she discovered the religious richness of Jewish religion. And I'm sure that after, as a Catholic, she was a better Jewish believer than before. The Catholic faith, the Christian faith, helped her to discover the richness of the Jewish religion.
She wasn't an atheist, as you said, but she was certainly a woman of doubt, a seeker.
Yes, a seeker. It's a very good word, a seeker.
Do you think that this doubt that she went through, this pain and this... One doubts, so there's always a bit of pain, no?
Yes, sort of moral pain.
Confirmed her so much as a staunch believer?
She was always seeking, and she was always seeking, because she didn't like to accept some things or some articles of faith when she hadn't studied them before as well as possible. It is interesting, before she converted to Catholic religion, she studied two very famous Catholic theologians, Johann Adam Möller and Matthias Scheben. In her times, these two professors were very famous with her dogmatic books. It means she wanted to understand the things well as possible with her intellect. And this means that she was doubting, but also seeking always.
When she made her eternal profession on the 21st of April, 1938, this erudite woman then, what you're saying, she was an erudite woman, she chose the words of another famous Carmelite, St. John of the Cross,
mm-hmm.
to be printed on her devotional picture.
Yes.
But she wrote, "Henceforth my only vocation is
mm-hmm.
love."
Yes.
So what is it? The mm-hmm. intellect and love go mm-hmm. together?
You must know that this text comes from the spiritual canticle of St. John of the Cross, the most outstanding poet in Spanish language. And she made a very good translation of this canticle later. I think that love and intellect are not in opposition, because a love without intellect is not good, and intellect without love is not even good.
So what you're saying, she's a very mature, complete
yes,
person.
Yes, exactly.
To
two qualities complementing each other. One of the most important themes of John Paul II in his last encyclica, I think it was his last encyclica when he spoke also about Edith Stein in this context. Fides
et ratio,
exactly.
Faith and reason, which is one of Pope Benedict XVI's great things.
He continues. Also, Deus Caritas is to have the thing.
God is love. One can't speak of Edith Stein without speaking of Auschwitz. I think that she is well known for her experience at Auschwitz and her witness.
I think it is one of the other points why she is such an important person, such an outstanding person of the last century, because she finished in Auschwitz, and she had accepted this kind of death willingly, even if she tried to escape until the last moment. She was always hoping, but she was at the same time very resigned to accept it as God had decided for her. I think she testimonies that God was present in Auschwitz, giving her strength. But I think it is a very difficult question. We cannot speak so easily about God, but Edith Stein was convinced until the last moment that God is with her.
When Benedict XVI, now Pope Emeritus, went to Auschwitz, he spoke of Edith Stein and he said of her that he felt a deep urge to pause in a particular way before the inscription in German evoking her.
Ad Auschwitz-Birkenau, e qui sono morti,
and he said he greatly hailed her and the others as witnesses to the truth and goodness, which even among our people were not eclipsed. We are grateful.
Ringraziamo queste persone.
Because they did not submit to the power of evil.
Perché non si sono sottomesse al potere del male.
And now they stand before us like lights shining in a dark night.
Ci stanno davanti come luci in una notte buia.
The reading of Edith Stein, a light shining in a dark night?
I think so, especially when we take in consideration her end, because her writings giving really a testimony about faith, and especially her last writing, Signs of the Cross, about St. John of the Cross, is finishing with the light of the resurrection. Edith Stein in her writing, Signs of the Cross, is giving a comment about all the writings of St. John of the Cross, putting her own experience. It is a mixture between a comment and testimony of life. It finishes with the light of the resurrection. We can suppose that in the last days before she was captured, she was writing this, because the writing is nearly finished, but it's only written by hand, it's a manuscript, and she was still working about it. And so we can suppose that in the last weeks before she was captured, she had developed these thoughts about the light of the resurrection, following the prayer of the Angelus. The Angelus is the angel of the Lord, that we can come through his suffering and cross to the glory of resurrection.
Edith Stein had to face the challenges of a radically changing century with its deep wounds and scars, a world of renunciation. No, she had to face that kind of world, whereas our Western world today is a world where everything is allowed. So what has she got to offer? What is the relevance of her witness to the new generations? There doesn't seem to be a lot in common.
I think that she was a person in search, a seeker. And I think under the relativism and under many other things we are living now, many persons are looking for values, are seeking for values, and so don't trust so easily the traditional values, but they are seeking. We should encourage the people to be seekers. Even if you are not always succeeding, maybe we are used to be succeeding, but faith is to be a seeker, in spite of all the insuccesses and all the problems you have, all the sins you are doing. It is important to remain in the way, to continue the way.
We mentioned two Carmelites earlier on in our talk, St. John of the Cross and St. Teresa of Avila, from whom she drew inspiration. Mm-hmm. Would you say that she has a particular Carmelite charism?
Yes, in a certain sense. She had entered very well in the traditional Carmelite charism, in the Theresian Carmelite charism.
Which, what is it? What is the Theresian?
The prayer, interior prayer. It's a typical Theresian charism when it was not so common in the order. And St. John of the Cross, yeah, she had understood him also, but maybe St. John of the Cross insists more in love. He doesn't never use the expression a science of cross, but a science of love. We know that the real love accepts also the cross, but Edith Stein insists more in the cross. There are many crosses in her life, many crosses, not only Auschwitz, not only Auschwitz.
St. Teresa, then, of the cross, where does the Benedicta come in then?
Benedicta, blessed by the cross, yes. Her name became a reality in her life.
And thanks there to Veronica Scarsbrick for that interview with Discalced Carmelite Father Ulrich Dobham. August the 5th marks the consecration of Rome's Basilica of St. Mary Major, the largest church in Rome dedicated to the Blessed Virgin. The date comes from the story of the miraculous snowfall on August the 5th in the year 358, on the site where the Basilica now stands, that was foretold during a vision by Mary to Pope Liberius and to a wealthy Roman couple. Every year on August the 5th, white rose petals are dropped from an opening in the ceiling of St. Mary Major to commemorate this story of the miraculous origin of the church in the 4th century. The Basilica of St. Mary Major is home to many stunning artworks, including the ancient and much venerated Marian icon, the Salus Populi Romani, that has been deeply revered by so many popes throughout the centuries. I went to the Basilica in the company of Liz Lev, an art historian who teaches at several universities in Rome. She began by describing for me the Salus Populi Romani icon that depicts Mary and the Christ child holding a gospel book.
Well, it's an image that's about 5 feet tall. It's the entire image is occupied by the Madonna and child. Mary is the dominant figure, obviously larger than the child. She's swathed in blue from head all the way down to three-quarter of her body. And her head is turned, inclined slightly towards the child. Her features are the delicate features that we expect of Byzantine icons, so sort of a gentle, unbroken line with the soft line of her nose. Again, all smooth, calm, a very small mouth. And then in her arms, there's the Christ child, the Christ child in her lap holding a copy of the gospel. So we have Mary indicating her son with long fingers, her son swathed in red, who in turn holds his word, the word of the gospel.
Tell us a little bit about the history, when and how this icon first arrived in Rome, as far as we know.
Well, the problem with icons is that they're very, very old, and so there are frequently differing stories on the origin of the icon. We hear about, in 593 AD, a procession that took place in Rome involving 40 different processions with Pope Gregory the Great presiding, and that this icon, the icon referred to as the Madonna Salus Populi Romani, was carried in the hands of Pope St. Gregory the Great in this procession. So we tend to assume that the icon came slightly before that. We assume that this is the same icon. That means the general date, based on the style, is often 590, because the style is sort of Grecian, Cretan type of style. But you'll find people arguing that actually the icon was repainted later in 700, and you'll find people claiming that this is an image painted by none other than St. Luke, the very first Madonna and Child. So you find a gamut of claims regarding the origin of that image.
Okay, so let's turn now to some of the other cultural treasures, the artworks in this basilica. It's got amazing ceilings, it's got amazing mosaics. Can you tell us a bit about some of the most outstanding examples?
What I always find amazing about this church is it has been loved by the Roman people and beyond for 1600 years, and it bears the marks, the signs of that love everywhere you look. So this church was built in the triumphant spirit of the wake of the Council of Ephesus in 432, when Mary was declared Theotokos, or God-bearer. Pope Sixtus III chose this site at the top of the Esquiline Hill, which was probably the most affluent neighborhood in Rome after the Palatine Hill. So he's going to build a church in the neighborhood where the people who live here, their grandparents built the temples. So they're very good taste. They're beautiful things. When you go to museums, you're looking at stuff that was taken out of their houses. And so the first decoration in this church is just a skin of splendid mosaics that date from the 4th century. And very well thought out, obviously meant to appeal to a very erudite class, where you have all the way down the nave little panels showing the stories of the patriarchs of the Jewish people. You see Abraham and Moses and Isaac and Joshua, and you're working your way down the nave through the story of salvation till you hit the triumphal arch, the arch above the altar, where you see what? The stories of the infancy of Christ, not the passion, but the stories of Mary, the God-bearer, and the Incarnation. And what I love about that image is you see Mary like you'll never see her before. It's the Annunciation like you've never seen it before, and you'll never see it again. Because to convince the class of Romans in the 5th century of the God-bearer, you can't show Mary as a poor girl. So she wears a princess outfit. She's surrounded by angel attendants. She always looks very queenly. And the other thing about the mosaic that's very special is it's the first time we see Joseph in the history of art. He makes his first appearance. So, and that's just the 5th century. And then you fast forward and we get probably in 590 the icon of the Madonna Salus Populi Romani. Then as the 1200s come along, we have this rise of the Franciscan order, and again such a devotion to the Incarnation and the Nativity that Arnolfo di Cambio made one of the earliest nativity sets, creche scenes, right? We associate Christmas and the papal creche scene. One of the very first papal creche scenes in history, made close to 1300 for this church by the man who ended up designing the Florentine Cathedral. And then, of course, the beautiful apse mosaics, which show Mary being crowned in heaven, all dating from this period. And then next thing you know, we have the New World in 1492, and gifts come from far away for this church. So then you look up at the ceiling, and this sort of extraordinarily richly, beautifully decorated ceiling in gold gilding, which comes, it's the first gold from the New World, brought to, of all people, Alexander VI Borgia. And before everybody turns off the radio, Alexander VI Borgia, I am the first person to admit, was not one of our better popes. But sometimes we forget that every now and then he tried. Every now and then He made a supreme effort to get himself back on track. Do you know he is the man who opened the holy door in this church, as well as the one in St. Peter's and St. Paul's outside the walls? He was given the first gold from the New World from Isabella and Ferdinand of Spain, and he donated it to this church because he had once been archpriest here. So he had a huge love of Mary, and indeed he is indirectly responsible for Michelangelo's Pietà.
Another major treasure in this basilica is a relic, is a reputed relic from the manger at Bethlehem. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, the first of all, the reputed relic, it's always hard with relics because who was there the day Jesus was born to see someone take a piece of the crib? And I doubt Mary and Jesus were packing it with them, and Mary and Joseph were packing it with them. However, there has been a fragment of wood in this church since the 8th century. The 8th century is an interesting date because the 8th century is the beginning of iconoclasm. So a great many important relics were brought from Jerusalem to Constantinople. But as of the mid-700s in Constantinople, they're destroying those relics. And so many people took what were the most precious of those relics and brought them to Rome where they would be safe. And that is the period when this manger, this fragment of the manger, came to this church. So it has a kind of interesting history to begin with.
Do we know who brought it?
I can't remember the order of the monks, but we do know it was an order of monks that were fleeing the iconoclast controversy. So we know that it was brought over by one of the many groups of what they called iconodules, people who cared about the art and cared about the relics. They were usually priestly communities, so monasteries. And they brought over with them either their artistic talents or very frequently they brought over actual relics. And that relic came here, and it also joined what is another reputed relic in here, although mysterious. I'm not entirely sure where it is, which are the remains of St. Jerome, who, if you remember, died in the cave in Bethlehem where Jesus was born while he was translating the gospel. And so what does that turn this church into? It turns it into a mini Bethlehem. So between the nativity set, between the relic of the manger, between the remains of St. Jerome, you have a way to come to Rome, be in this church, and be in a Roman Bethlehem, really feel this space in the church dedicated to the God-bearer where Christ first came into the world to begin his salvific mission. The person who probably did the most to create that image for us was Pope Sixtus V, whose chapel is exactly opposite the chapel of the Madonna Salus Popoli Romani, was the first Blessed Sacrament chapel to be constructed in a major basilica in Rome, and really giving us, when he built it, he put the relic of the crib underneath the altar. He then put the floating tabernacle and then a dome modeled after St. Peter's at the top to really give us this vision of the incarnation, redemption, the sacrament of the Eucharist in heaven. So a very powerful vertical. So there's a great deal that goes on in this church, which is exceptional.
And I was talking there to Liz Lev, an art historian who teaches at several universities in Rome. And that's all we have time for in today's programme. Thanks so much for joining us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudator Jesus Christus.